This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with the author of an alarming UN report titled Global Threats to Freedom of Expression Arising from the Conflict in Gaza. Our guest is Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression.
We speak with Professor Emeritus from Purdue University, Bill Mullen, on Black resistance to fascism. Bill's written two books, We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law, and The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition. What Bill has to say is profound. We can't rely on anything but ourselves in the streets, demonstrating from day one if Trump is elected.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. On top of the devastating humanitarian crisis and the issues of genocide and violations of human rights in Gaza and the West Bank, there has been an unprecedented attack on freedom of the press and freedom of expression globally, prompted by that war. In August, Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right of Freedom of Opinion and Expression, issued an alarming report examining the impact of the conflict in Gaza on freedom of expression throughout the world. The report highlights, quote, attacks on journalists and media restrictions endangering access to information about the conflict globally, suppression of protests and dissent, and undermining of academic and artistic freedom in polarized political environments, and restrictions on legitimate political expression in the name of fighting terrorism and anti-Semitism. The special rapporteur assessed the compliance of states, social media companies, and other private actors with international human rights standards, online and offline, and she found, and I quote, an extensive pattern of unlawful, discriminatory, and disproportionate restrictions on advocacy for the rights of Palestinian people, unquote. The report emphasized, quote, the importance of freedom of opinion and expression, enjoyed on an equal basis by all sides, as an invaluable tool for fighting hate and encouraging mutual respect and dialogue. Based on her detailed findings, the special rapporteur called on states, social media companies, and other private actors to reject double standards on human rights and made concrete recommendations for them to uphold the right to freedom of opinion and expression equally for all. To discuss these serious issues, we're so pleased and honored to have with us Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression. Appointed on August 1, 2020, Ms. Khan is the first woman to hold this position since the establishment of the mandate in 1993. UN Special Rapporteurs are independent human rights experts with a mandate to report and advise on human rights from a thematic perspective. As part of her role, Ms. Khan conducts country visits, acts on individual cases, and sends official communications to governments, and presents thematic reports to the UN General Assembly. An internationally recognized advocate for human rights, gender equality, and social justice, Ms. Khan teaches at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Geneva and is co-author of The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights, which has been published in 7 languages. Ms. Khan was previously Secretary General of Amnesty International from 2001 to 2009. Under her leadership, Amnesty strengthened its work on political and civil rights, especially in the context of armed conflicts. the first woman to head Amnesty International, she launched its first global campaign to stop violence against women and girls. Special Rapporteur Irene Khan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Your report begins by explaining that the foundation of the right to freedom of opinion and expression, like all human rights, is the right to non-discrimination. You note first that everyone has an equal right to exercise their freedom of opinion and expression, and second, the equal enjoyment of freedom of expression means that it cannot be used as a license to incite discrimination, hostility, and violence against others. Tell us how these rights are enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights.
Well, freedom of opinion and expression is a pillar of democracy. It is also a very important tool for empowering people. And as such, it enjoys a special position, I think, in the hierarchy, in the system, in the human rights system. But it must be enjoyed equally. Freedom of expression guarantees in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but also in key regional instruments such as the European Convention on Human Rights and the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights, that it is the right to seek, receive, share information and ideas of all kinds, true or false, offensive or enlightened, regardless of frontiers or choice of media. So it's a very broad right. It protects media freedom, political views. It allows the criticism of governments or religions or ideologies or kings or precedents, policies or institutions. It allows intellectual discourse, academic discussion, advocacy of human rights, cultural and artistic expression, sexual expression, from what we wear to what we say to how we express our identity. It's vital. But while it is a very broad right, it is not an absolute right. And that is where the Balancing Act comes in. It can be restricted under certain circumstances to protect the reputation and rights of others, also to protect national security, public health, public order, or public morals. But because of the fundamental role that freedom of expression plays in relation to our own individual dignity, but also in relation to democracy, the restrictions must be precise, the restrictions must be construed narrowly, and they must be necessary and proportionate. In some cases, and here's where the issue of hate speech comes in, it can be prohibited as well, but again, under some very clear criteria, so that legitimate protected speech is not infringed in the process of restricting other kinds of speech.
Yes, and that brings us right to my next question, because I wanted to focus in on the question of hate speech. Hate speech is not a term in the international rhetoric. It's often used in the United States. But the International Covenant does prohibit the advocacy of national and racial and religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence. But is the advocacy of hatred by itself sufficient to justify prohibition? And in that connection, tell us about the Rabat Plan of Action that clarifies this very contentious area of free expression.
Well, international law is very pro-speech, and it recognizes that around the world there will be different interpretations of what is or is not hate speech, and that lines have to be drawn very carefully so that governments do not infringe on legitimate criticism or label legitimate criticism as hate speech and prohibit it. So therefore, just the advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred is not in itself sufficient to be prohibited. Along with it, there has to be this element of incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence. So there needs to be likely harm. And what is offensive may be permitted or in some societies, it may be restricted, providing, you know, the restriction follows the criteria I mentioned earlier. But when it comes to hate speech, it has to be prohibited. However, that prohibition should only be there where there is likelihood of incitement to violence, discrimination, or hostility. So in that way, there's some kind of a balance created between my right to speak and my right not to hurt you. The Rabat Plan of Action was actually, are actually some guidelines that were developed through consultation with civil society, with various stakeholders, from religious leaders to community leaders, academics, and so on, by the United Nations. And what it does is, in the context of hate speech, it looks at the context in which it occurs. So if I'm ranting away against someone in my shower, then it should not be prohibited, because in my shower I can do what I want and I'm not harming anyone. But if I'm a political leader standing in front of 500 people, giving a major statement, and then I attack some religious group or some ethnic group or others, then obviously the impact is going to be quite different. And it's so one has to look at the context, the speaker, the content, and so on. There are 7 criteria like that before judging whether such speech should be prohibited. Rabat also looks at why hate speech happens. What are the different reasons for it? And promotes the idea of education, of awareness building, of community action at the level of the community to eradicate hate speech, and not simply to criminalize it, because criminal law by itself rarely is effective. Besides that, it's a very severe means of restricting speech. So it should be done in the most egregious cases, but there are a whole host of other ways in which hate speech can be tackled.
Yes, your references to counter speech and education remind us in America of the more speech doctrine of Justice Louis Brandeis. Let me come to a key portion of your report. You call a pattern of attacks on journalists in Gaza, and I quote, indicates a deliberate strategy of the Israeli military to silence critical reporting and obstruct documentation of possible international crimes, unquote. Please summarize the killings and arbitrary detention of journalists and the destruction of press facilities in Gaza.
Well, first of all, let me start with the numbers. They're quite horrendous. In the last 12 months, around 138 journalists have been killed in Gaza. It is the deadliest conflict for journalists since the UNESCO, the UN body that keeps a record of journalists who've been killed, since they began to keep their record. It's been the deadliest conflict. And of course, many of the journalists who have been killed have been killed because of the heavy bombing and the intensity of the fighting. But there have also been several cases of targeted killing of journalists. And that is where, to which I refer in my report, where journalists wearing clearly identifiable jackets and helmets marked as press, traveling in well-marked vehicles, have been attacked by the Israeli army while they were clearly carrying out what one would call reporting functions, such as taping a scene of recent fighting or an attack or buildings that had been destroyed or people that had been injured. In those situations, they were killed, attacked. So there is a lot of evidence and testimony that indicates that in these kind of situations, it's very likely that the Israeli defense forces were aware that these were journalists who had been killed. When Israel has been confronted by these incidents, their response has been that these journalists are actually agents or supporters of Hamas, but Israel has not provided any credible evidence of that, nor has it allowed any independent investigations, nor has it, the Israeli army or the government itself, investigated these killings. So journalists are being killed in situations where they are clearly carrying out journalistic activities, and then they're being labeled as agents. And it seems very likely from that that the purpose there was to, first of all, stop them from doing whatever they were, shooting the film, talking to people that they were doing, but also it's a way of also seeking to cover up war crimes that are taking place in Gaza. And I would say the killing of journalists is just one element. There are more. Secondly, we have seen massive damage of media facilities, of live streaming cameras. And again, there is video material to suggest that these cameras were deliberately targeted by Israeli tanks and destroyed. Again, one would ask, why would the army do that? Then, of course, there has also been the situation that Israel has so far refused to allow any international media journalists, international journalists, to enter Gaza, except for one case. I think there was only one case throughout this 1 year, which is extremely unusual. On the one hand, the Israeli Defense Forces are saying that the local journalists who are working on behalf of international outlets are pro-Hamas or Hamas associates, and therefore they're being killed, but on the other hand, is refusing to allow international outlets such as CNN or BBC to come. So you've got this kind of a situation where it seems that from, and of course, dozens of journalists have been arrested, detained. There are allegations of torture against them. So from all sides, it seems that there is a deliberate attempt to suppress media freedom. And suppression of media freedom means lack of information, not just for the population there or for the Israeli population, but for the world. So it's a way of kind of shutting down the information stream to the rest of the world, and therefore a violation of freedom of expression, not only of the journalists, but also of the audience around the world.
Turning to Israel itself, in April, the Israeli parliament adopted the Foreign Media Law. Please describe this law, how it has been used, and why you're concerned that it is inconsistent with international human rights standards.
Well, let me start by saying that I'm deeply concerned by the state of media freedom inside Israel. Israeli media, especially those that are critical of the government, are being threatened and intimidated. Censorship of Israeli media by the government has become much tougher following the October 7th attacks. And some journalists in Israel say that they're afraid to express dissenting views. There have been mob attacks on journalists, as well as reports of intimidation by the authorities, and sometimes authorities vilifying the journalists that have led to these attacks. In April this year, the Israeli parliament adopted the Foreign Media Law, which gives wide powers to the executive to ban foreign media and to impose other restrictions on foreign media without any prior judicial review. So the power is left entirely in the hands of the executive. Following that law in April, very soon afterwards, Israel put a temporary ban on Al Jazeera. And then in June, the law was amended to make permanent bans possible. And as soon as that happened, the permanent ban was slapped on Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera's office has been closed in East Jerusalem. It was recently they raided, the Israeli forces raided the Al Jazeera office in Ramallah and closed that down as well. So this law is being labeled by some as the Al Jazeera law, but I see it as a wider threat. At any moment, a media outlet, foreign media outlet, could be shut down. Now, that shutting down an entire outlet is a very severe blow to media freedom because it reduces media diversity. You get rid of one particular outlet. It's also, of course, violating the right to information of the Israeli public. They have a right to access foreign media. Freedom of expression is a right that crosses borders. So I see this as disproportionate, unnecessary, and a very dangerous move to ban an entire outlet and to exercise it so rapidly against Al Jazeera. And of course, it could be done against any other outlet at any time simply by a decision of the executive. And only the judicial review takes place only later. So this is clearly disproportionate, unnecessary, and those are the criteria that you remember that I mentioned earlier are necessary to restrict freedom of expression. And that's why I believe that this is a violation of international law.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. Today we're joined by Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. You devote an entire section of your report to the suppression of protest and dissent around the world. I think our American audience would be particularly interested in your findings on how the repression of protests in the United States, and especially on American college campuses, has been disproportionately directed at stigmatizing pro-Palestinian advocacy, and how university authorities have failed to respect the equal protection of the rights of all students and faculty.
Well, in the United States, over a period of something like 6 months between, or 8 months between October last year and June this year, there were over 10,000 demonstrations, from mass street protests, public rallies, student in campus, vigils, other kinds of public assemblies. Most of them were held peacefully, and yet the authorities resorted to repressive measures, widespread police action, for example, to remove the demonstrators. 45 pieces of legislation is being proposed by state and federal lawmakers, all aimed at restricting street protests, basically punishing student protesters, stigmatizing Palestinian advocates as being supporters of Hamas, in other words, as supporting terrorism. Now, what was particularly, I would say, shameful in the United States was the crackdown on student protests. There were, as you will recall, there were mass encampments were set up in colleges and universities in more than 25 states. Again, the protests were largely peaceful, although some Jewish students felt fearful on the campus. They complained of not being well protected and so on. But there were no mass attacks, nothing of that kind. And yet, in some cases, riot police were brought in to disrupt and remove the encampments. And universities such as Columbia, which has a tradition, a long tradition of student activism, took some of the harshest measures against the students. Many of the students who participated have been threatened with suspension, expulsion, eviction from campus housing. Foreign students were threatened with deportation. Many of them have lost job offers from future employers. So in effect, as a result of their protest, their future has been jeopardized. What is also very concerning is the way in which academic institutions allowed politicians and donors to put pressure on them to disrupt these protests. Rather than handling these protests within the context of academic freedom and campus activities, without trying to actually include students, discuss with them what was happening, and make it a learning experience from students, whether they were pro-Israeli or pro-Palestinian, academic administrators resorted to the use of force and harsh punishment. And there has been a chilling effect as a result of that, not only in relation to students, but also in relation to scholars. Many scholars now claim that they are unable to actually carry out the kind of research they would want to do. They fear that they may be labeled as anti-Semitic. They may be threatened by their funders and so on. And as a result of that, a lot of discussion, debate on the Palestinian situation has been chilled on campus, and a lot of research has stopped. That's going to have an impact on policymaking in the US as well, because as you know, it's through academia, through the work of scholars, that political policymaking, the process of policymaking is enriched. So it's really quite an attack on academic freedom in the US. And I say that particularly because the US has been a role model on academic independence and autonomy around the world. And this sends a terrible message to others, many countries, which don't believe in freedom of expression in the way in which the US does. So I think it's got a global impact. It's going to have a global impact, what has happened in US campuses.
I'm a graduate of Columbia Law School, and I was ashamed of my school in that period. I hope they can take your report into consideration and others to look forward to this school year protecting more robustly the right to protest. Now, turning to a very important section on your report, you express serious concern that when it comes to Palestinian advocacy and here I'm quoting again, "There has been a tendency to confuse and conflate criticism of the policies of Israel, which is a legitimate exercise of freedom of expression, with anti-Semitism, which is racial and religious hatred against Jews that must be condemned," unquote. Please elaborate as fully as you like on this concern, including how the European Court of Human Rights has dealt with this issue, and why you conclude that the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism contravenes international standards on freedom of expression.
Well, you know, in the context of freedom of expression, the most challenging issue is where to draw the line between protected speech and prohibited speech. And international law, being pro-speech, tends to lean towards restricting prohibited speech and expanding protected speech. Now, here, when we look at anti-Semitism, it's a serious form of religious and racial hatred. And of course, states and private actors must take all measures to fight it. It should be prohibited. There's absolutely no issue about that. But it is very important that the fight against anti-Semitism should be framed in accordance with international human rights standards, so that there is a shared understanding, human rights being universal values, a shared understanding of the problem and its root causes, and therefore better ways of eradicating it. Now, international human rights law draws a clear line between political criticism, from which no state can be shielded, and anti-Semitism, which is a serious form of religious hatred, as I said, and should be condemned. The genocide in Gaza, the violation of human rights in the occupied territories, Israel's failure to respect its international obligations, including the occupation, these are all matters of global public interest. There is no scope for restricting freedom of expression. In other words, criticism of any of these issues, debate about any of these issues. But what I see is an instrumentalization of anti-Semitism by redefining it and therefore politicizing this whole effort, which seems geared towards protecting Israel from being attacked rather than ensuring that people, Jewish people, are protected from hate speech, from hostility, from violence. You raise the issue of the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement. The European Court decision was actually about this BDS movement. What this movement is about is it asks Israel to end occupation. It wants Israel to treat all its citizens equally, not just make no discrimination between Jewish and non-Jewish citizens. And it also talks about the right of return for Palestinian refugees. All these issues, you may agree or disagree with those issues, but all of them are lawful issues for discussion under international law. The case of the European court case was in relation to some protesters in France, BDS protesters, and the European court said that boycott actually is a legitimate means of expressing political opinion. It's not discrimination. It promotes differential treatment with the purpose of ensuring substantive equality and in a proportionate manner. So it is not unlawful, and it recognized BDS as a political activity. BDS activity, however, is regarded in a number of Western countries, including the United States, and a number of the US states actually have laws against it, as well as Germany, as being discriminatory and anti-Semitic. But the European Court has said, no, it is political expression, and therefore it is legitimate. Now, the International Holocaust Remembrance Association's definition of anti-Semitism raises some serious concerns. First of all, the language is very vague. So there is what in the legal areas, you know, we call legal certainty is missing, which means it can lead to wrongful accusations of anti-Semitism. It can damage people's reputation. It can distort statistics. It can divert attention from the real causes of anti-Semitism. What this definition also does, it has gives certain examples, 11 examples of the way in which anti-Semitism may occur. 7 of those 11 are really relating to Israel's behavior. So again, it is mixing the political with hate speech, the political criticism, which is valid, with the prohibited hate speech. And that conflates Zionism with anti-Semitism. Now, anti-Semitism is, of course, hatred against Jews. Zionism is a political ideology. We may agree or disagree with it, but it's a political ideology, and therefore, like other political ideologies, should be open to criticism. Zionism is not an inherent characteristic of an individual or a group, so it's wrong to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And the issue here also is that many Jewish people who are pro-Palestinian have come to me, students as well, student groups and others, come to me and said that they are being attacked by other Jewish people, but that is not being seen as anti-Semitism, although they are Jews and they're being attacked for their belief. So this conflation between what is political speech and should be protected from restriction and what is hate speech or anti-Semitism and should be condemned is very dangerous and is counterproductive. Rather than actually addressing anti-Semitism, eradicating anti-Semitism, it's increasing discrimination against one group at the cost of another group, and therefore I think is counterproductive.
Today and in your report, you've brought so much clarity to this issue. I wish you had been there last December when the college presidents were grilled on these issues, and they garbled these distinctions which you have made so clear today and in your report. Irene Kahn, thank you so much for your participation today at Law and Disorder. Your report contains important conclusions and recommendations. Where can listeners find your report and read it for themselves?
They can find it on the website of the UN, as well as on my website, srfriedex.org. The document number is A/79/319, and the title is Global Threats to Freedom of Expression Arising from the Conflict in Gaza.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and even more so for everything you do daily to protect freedom of expression around the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
National chauvinism and racism are essential features of fascism. The practice of white racism in the United States during the Jim Crow era was something that Hitler's fascist party in Germany studied and emulated. This kind of anti-black racism went on in the United States from shortly after the Civil War up until the 1960s. And indeed, it's never really gone away, as the mass mobilizations of the Black Lives Matter movement recently demonstrated. This black resistance, this fight back, will be a central aspect of anti-fascist activity in the future. Here to speak with us today is Professor Bill Mullen, the co-author of The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition, and his new book, published last month, We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law. Bill Mullen is a professor emeritus of American Studies at Purdue University and the co-founder of the Campus Anti-Fascist Network. Professor Bill Mullen, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Bill, the great Jewish-Italian writer Primo Levi, who himself spent time in an Italian fascist prison camp when Mussolini was the dictator in Italy in the 30s, has observed that there are many kinds of fascism. Has fascism historically existed in this country? And if so, in what ways, both historically and currently?
Well, we've never had a full-blown fascist state in the United States, but we've had a regular stream of fascist movements. During the period of classical fascism that you reference in the 1930s, there were groups like the Black Legion, which were very sympathetic, that formed in the United States, that were very sympathetic to European fascism. There was a group called the German-American Bund, which was basically incentivized by the rise of fascism in Germany. And they famously had a giant rally with 20,000 people at Madison Square Garden in 1939, which is a moment that most of us have forgotten about. I mean, if you fast forward to the late 50s, in 1959, you had the American Nazi Party was formed by a guy named George Lincoln Rockwell, was a kind of a street-level force in the 1960s, you know, attacking civil rights protesters and the like. And in our time, you know, the landscape is kind of littered with neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups that come and go, groups like the Traditionalist Workers' Party, which was actually founded by a guy named Matthew Heimbach. There's the Patriot Front. There's the Proud Boys, which, of course, Donald Trump made famous by genuflecting to a couple years ago. And there are others. All of them are kind of unified usually by, you know, a form of authoritarian white supremacy, misogyny, and anti-democratic politics, you know, combined with street-level fighting forces. So we've never not, since the 1930s, had some fascist current or movement alive in the United States.
Bill, in your book, which you co-authored with Janelle Hope, called The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition, you write about quite a few magnificent struggles. Can you give us a brief description of the highlights of some of those struggles? For example, what did Ida B. Wells work on?
Ida B. Wells was the champion of anti-lynching. She wrote a book called The Red Record, which was a chronicle in 1895 of the huge numbers of lynchings that had taken place in the United States across the South, especially since the end of the Civil War. She had her own newspaper dedicated primarily to trying to abolish lynching. And we talk about her as what we call a premature anti-fascist, because she understood the relationship between racial violence, racial terrorism, and the role of the state. And in fact, in 1917, 1918, 1919, in her own newspaper, in addition to writing about lynching, she was pointing to the parallels between lynchings in America and the pogroms, you know, taking place in Europe against Jews. Now, this was well before the rise of formal fascism, but we argue in the book that she's a great example of how black radicals, especially, who've been always attuned to things like racial violence, oftentimes anticipated fascism before other groups. W.E.B. Du Bois, in 1915, when he was writing about, you know, World War I, talked about the kinds of techniques being used in the colonies as what he later understood to be like templates for the rise of fascism. Du Bois actually went to Germany in 1934 because he was aware that of what was happening to the Jews. Wells is a great example in our book of a tradition that begins in the early 20th century of black anti-fascism. We talk about the Black Panther Party, which in the late 1960s, you know, organized a huge United Front Against Fascism conference in Oakland, which drew about 5,000 people and was really committed to trying to theorize the potentiality of a fascist state emerging in the United States, primarily because of its use of mass incarceration and police violence. So those are two ends of the spectrum, and in between we talk about some other movements as well.
In your new book titled We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law, you write about the petition a number of lawyers brought in 1950. Please put this petition in context for us. Where was it brought? Who wrote it? And what did it charge specifically?
Sure. The petition was called We Charge Genocide. It was authored by a group called the Civil Rights Congress. The Civil Rights Congress had emerged out of the Communist Party's work in the United States in the 1940s. Its leader was a black attorney named William Patterson. It had other participants in the petition campaign included W.E.B. Du Bois, who I talked about earlier, and Paul Robeson, the singer and activist. The petition was drafted originally in 1948, and it used the United Nations' new definition of genocide, which was part of its Convention on Human Rights, and applied it to black life in the United States. And what they did was chronicle the long histories of slavery, colonialism, police violence, lynchings, to argue that the Genocide Convention and its definition should actually be applied to the long history of anti-black violence in the United States. They brought it to the United Nations in 1951, formally submitted it, were hoping that it would be deliberated on the floor of the UN. That never happened because the US State Department used all of its power to make sure that the petition never reached the floor, was never actually formally voted on. Eleanor Roosevelt actually played a very large role in suppressing it. And the intention was to bring international attention to the plight of black folks and to draw analogies between the recent Holocaust in Europe and what they understood to be the sort of the slow genocide that black people had been subjected to from the earliest days of America's, you know, settler colonial state. It's a real extraordinary document. It's still available as a book from international publishers that gets reprinted regularly. And it's very relevant to our time as we're, you know, reviewing things like the International Court of Justice bringing genocide charges against the State of Israel for the war in Gaza. I highly recommend folks go back and take a look at the way that these attorneys framed in 1951 charges of genocide against the U.S. state.
We're speaking with Professor Bill Mullen on his two books on American fascism and black resistance. Bill, who are the people you're trying to reach with your book, We Charge Genocide? At whom was it aimed? What do you want readers to come away learning from it?
Well, I wrote this book because, you know, there's been a lot of attention being paid to the rise of fascism globally in the last 10 or 15 years, not just in the United States, but in places like Poland and Brazil and the Philippines. We're obviously living in a reign of new authoritarianism. And I wanted to look at the role that the law had played in the not only the rise of fascism, but the implementation of fascism. One of the myths of American democracy is that, you know, the rule of law will save us from things like dictatorship. But in fact, German fascism and Italian fascism both used the courts and the law specifically to implement fascism and fascist rule. In fact, some of that was actually borrowed from the United States. The German jurisprudence during the Nazi years borrowed heavily from American Jim Crow law, for example. So I wanted to remind people that the law is not always our friend when it comes to fighting fascism, and in fact that the law can actually be our enemy. And I was kind of motivated to this by the attention that the Black Lives Matter movement had given to the role of police in our society, and I wanted to kind of go one level past the police and look at the role of the law. Obviously, you know, the courts and the legal system empower the cops to do the kinds of things that we've been protesting the last 10 years, you know, meaning particularly violence against black populations and the like. So I really feel like activists and organizers need to study the law and its kind of sometimes pernicious role and include it in our menu of things that we resist when we're trying to resist the suppression of democracy. So that was one of my target audiences. And the other is, you know, scholars who have actually written about this quite a bit. James Whitman, who this brilliant law professor wrote this book called Hitler's American Model, which documents the very specific ways in which the Nazi courts used Jim Crow law to build, for example, the Nuremberg laws. And all of the codifications of anti-Semitism were directly borrowed from the American model of anti-black legal racism in the United States. So I really feel in the time that we're living in, whether or not you think Trump is a fascist, and Trump, you notice that Trump is also very adroit at using the courts, you cannot separate the rule of law from the potentiality of fascism. They're always intertwined.
You better believe it. Bill, you believe that the U.S. legal system has contributed to the growth of fascist states and fascist movements domestically and internationally. How did it do this here in the USA?
Well, one was the example I just gave of the usage of Jim Crow laws, which, you know, after the end of Reconstruction, the rise of Ku Klux Klan terrorism and lynchings in the South was all enabled by the courts. We have to understand that Jim Crow was a legal infrastructure, and it gave rise to a long period of white supremacy. I include the Ku Klux Klan in my catalog of American fascist groups, for example. In the contemporary period, I have a chapter in my book about what's called in legal scholarship, it's called legal originalism. And it's the argument that the only laws that have valence or should be considered legitimate are those that are in the original Constitution. This is a really interesting movement that began with the Southern segregationists in the 1950s who were trying to find ways of blocking the Supreme Court's attempts, like Brown versus Board of Education, to force integration on the American South. And one of the arguments that they begin to make and carries through for really all through up until the current moment is that laws like the 14th Amendment, which gave citizenship to black people after the end of slavery, are not legitimate laws because they're not original to the Constitution. In other words, they're add-on and amendments. Well, since the 1960s, a lot of white power and Christian identity movements have used this very same argument of legal originalism to argue that only white people are legitimate citizens of the United States. So Jews, blacks, anybody else who wasn't included in the original constitutional definition are not what they call sovereigns. So I find this really interesting because this legal originalism was both popular during the 1980s, during the Reagan years, when people like Ed Meese, for example, were trying to bring forward and pack the courts with legal originalists as a way of diminishing the appeal, the potentiality of civil rights in the United States. And on the ground, white supremacist groups in the American Northwest began their own constitutional forums. They began to have constitutional conventions to kind of rewrite the American Constitution and write out these post-constitutional amendments. So I think this is really important because white supremacy, which is baked into the Constitution, has been recaptured by illegal originalists as a founding fathers argument. And so when you hear right-wing attorneys these days invoking legal originalism, there we should also remember that there's a really pernicious thread of racist, nativist ideology that they are also invoking by invoking constitutional originalism. So that this is one way in which I think fascism and its potential remains alive through legal argument.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith, your host, and I'm speaking with Professor Bill Mullen on his two books on fascism and the law and the black struggle. Bill, because of the very nature of black oppression in the USA, the resistance to it will be at the heart of any kind of anti-fascist movement here. What lessons do you draw from your understanding of the history of black resistance?
Well, one of the things Janelle and I argue in our book is that fascism always is an anti-black ideology. And we recover, for example, the writings of people like M.A. Césaire and Walter Rodney, who made the connection between colonial racism and the rise of fascism. And they essentially put Africa and the lives of black people at the center when they asked the question, where did fascism come from? M.A. Césaire famously said, fascism in Europe was simply the tactics and techniques of colonialism coming home to roost against the white population in Europe, right? So to think about the history of blackness in the Western world is to like recenter it when we think about the long trajectories that have led to fascism, not just the events of the 19-teens and the 1920s. So that's one. Secondly, we point out that I mentioned people like Ida B. Wells and Du Bois and the Civil Rights Congress. They've always understood the particular anti-black role of the police and the state and the law. And they always have understood it as an ingredient of fascism. That's why Du Bois, we write about a woman named Thyra Edwards, who was a black activist in the 1930s. They were going to Germany and writing about the rise of fascism in the early 30s, well before it was even being covered by the mainstream media in the United States, because they understood fascism directly as an attack on black life potential. Obviously, fascism in Italy and Germany, for example, was also coded as very strongly anti-black. I mean, Mussolini, by the late 1930s, Italy had also codified blackness as a form of racial inferiority. So looking at anti-black fascism and the role of anti-blackness in fascism, we feel is really important. And it's a story that hasn't really been told, partly because there's so much attention, obviously, to Europe as a site of fascism, and also the questions of anti-Semitism. And we feel like putting anti-blackness in conversation with anti-Semitism is really, really important. These are two forms of racism that you know, co-constitute each other historically, at least on the far right.
Let's talk about the Trump phenomena. Former Chief of Staff General Kelly said yesterday that he believed that Trump was a fascist, and he said it fit the classical definition of fascism. What is your understanding of the classical definition of fascism, and how do you appreciate the Trump phenomena?
Well, I align myself with people who describe fascism as a crisis in capitalism that is resolved by the use of extreme force, extra legality, discipline and punishment of the working class, and attacks on vulnerable populations, whoever they might be. All of those things have a long history in the United States. I see Donald Trump as the end product of American history. He simply taps into nativism, anti-black racism, misogyny, and appeals to authority and authoritarianism that have always been part of the American political landscape. He's simply a new embodiment of many of these ideas. I think what's important about Trumpism, though, too, is that it comes from below. I believe that Trumpism as a phenomenon was anticipated by the rise of white power and white supremacist groups in the 80s and the 90s. The Tea Party movement around 2008 and 9, if you remember that, was a prototype for what became Trumpism. Like many fascist-leaning people, Trump has dog-whistled and appealed directly to that base. And, you know, one way to think about whether Trump is a fascist or not, and I don't believe his first term was a fascist term, but if January 6th had happened at the beginning of his term as opposed to the end, we might be having a different conversation about whether Trump is a fascist. If he's reelected, we'll see. We'll see exactly what happens on day one. I do think, you know, Angela Davis said in 1971, fascism is a process, not necessarily a product. And clearly, Trump is part of and aware of historical processes which he has exploited to enable and advance the potentiality of fascism in the United States. That's how I see it, and we'll have to see how, you know, the election plays out and what happens next.
Well, let's assume that Trump gets elected. What do we do? What can we learn from your books about what to do?
Well, I think the first thing we should do is realize that the courts are not going to save us. The lawyers are not going to save us. The cops are not going to save us. The legal apparatus is not going to save us. What we need is mass mobilization. The only way to beat fascism is to mobilize against it on the streets and to outnumber them. And you can't do that with lawyers, you know, as much as I love some lawyers. So what we really need to do is be ready to mobilize again if Trump is elected. I mean, I remember in 2017 after Charlottesville, you know, 50,000 people showed up, more or less, in Boston when the new far right was trying to organize after Charlottesville. That was a really important moment. We have to be ready to do that kind of thing again. We might have to be able to do it on election night. Trump's lawyers have already filed apparently 100 lawsuits to declare the results of the election illegitimate even before it happens. So fascism is at its core anti-democratic. Trump is at his core is anti-democratic. So I believe that we're going to need the possibilities of mass mobilization sooner rather than later after this election.
And what do you think the role of the Democratic Party has been and will be?
Well, I think they're an enabler of the far right. I think they have stood by and large, while the right has grown and strengthened itself. But the Democratic Party aligning itself with the police, aligning itself with the war against Palestinians, they've made it clear that they're comfortable with racial violence and state power on their own terms. These are really things that, you know, don't distinguish them in many ways from the right wing of the United States. So I think we should put no stock in the Democratic Party as a break on the increasing move to the right in this country. Win or lose, the right is going to continue to grow and struggle in this country. And the Democratic Party has, I mean, the Democratic Party right now is, you know, is lionizing people like Dick Cheney, who, you know, most of us remember as a war criminal from 20 years ago, who legitimated, you know, the torture of inmates at Guantanamo. So the Democratic Party has made peace with its own versions of authoritarianism and racial violence and state terrorism. They're not a friend of us when we're thinking about organizing against fascism.
Yeah. I would add to that the phenomena of Harris campaigning in Pennsylvania for fracking. And I would also add to that the phenomena of the close down of the campus encampments, which was done with the permission of the Democratic Party. So I think that with respect to the climate movement and democratic rights, we have to be very, very cautious about throwing any kind of support to them. Bill, we're almost, unfortunately, at the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you, do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
I think people should be ready to organize on election night and be prepared for the worst possible outcome. And we need to, if we're going to achieve democracy in this country, it's going to have to be won by people out on the streets and organizing from below. And that's, I think, the way it's always been. And I don't think it's going to be any different after election night. So I hope people are making preparations for that.
Thank you, Bill Mullen. Thank you very much for your fine work in this excellent interview. Bill, tell our audience how people can stay in touch with you and your work.
My book with Janelle Hope on Black Anti-Fascism is available from Haymarket Books, and my We Charge Genocide book is available from Fordham University Press, and I'm on Facebook, but I don't really do a lot of other social media. My email address is at the Purdue University website, where I'm a professor emeritus. People could reach out to me through that email if they'd like to have a conversation.
Very good. Thank you so much, Bill Mullen, for being our guest on Law and Disorder Radio. You take it easy.
Thanks, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
A quick reminder, if you want to listen to Law & Disorder's podcast, one way to do that is visit lawanddisorder.org. There you'll see our podcast players now positioned at the bottom of each show's post. And there you can click on the three dots in the right corner of the player to either, well, download, subscribe, or visit the podcast page. Good. That's great.